Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, he's back. Dear friend of the program, Matthew Penny is here. It's been a big few days in Boston sports, so I figured that I needed to give Penny an extra 24 hours to be able to recover. We had the Red Sox beating the Yankees in an elimination wildcard game. We had Tom Brady coming back to Foxborough to play the New England Patriots. How has your body and mind recovered, Penny? Massachusetts basketball legend Matthew Penny, by the way.
Thank you for proper intro. I thought you were going to throw Stephon Gilmore in there too, just to jab at my heart.
Range of emotions. About Gilmore,
wide range of emotions, and you had an extra 24 hours for me because the story behind the story is I had car issues. My computer charger's at work. My laptop is on like 26%. Like, all right, let's do it tomorrow. So I ended up going and walking around the Fenway area before the Yankees game. I promise that wasn't like a dog ate my homework thing. Like, I legitimately didn't have my charger.
It's so funny.
I got to breathe in the rivalry.
Yeah, you texted me and our mutual friend like stopped at your house and you guys went into the game together and you were like, yeah, I just forgot my cord or whatever at home. And I was like, wait. Our buddy is there. Go into the city and like have fun. Like, what are we doing here? We'll record tomorrow.
I don't want to be the guy who says, yeah, fill in with another guest. And then, oh, yeah, I'm going to have Cal Ripken on the show for the next 4,000 pods. I can't lose my spot. It worked out well because he was going in and he had tickets. And I just went in to have a couple of college sodas and scope out the area and got my time. I checked the box with the Schwartzies, Fitzies, Sullies, and then all the cartoon character Yankees fans. It was awesome, though. I recommend it to anybody that if there's a big time game at Fenway, just even to walk around, you don't have to go in. It was quite the scene. I'll leave it at that.
It's a huge bummer because I've never been to a playoff baseball game for the team I root for, because obviously it's the Pirates, and the Pirates were fucking terrible for the first 20 years of my life, basically. And then right when they got good and made the playoffs was right when I moved to LA in 2014 2015, you know, right around that area. So I couldn't even like go back out over there, because the first year, the one where like Johnny Cueto like dropped the ball because the fans had like gotten his head so bad, like I had like, I think, finals for grad school like that night or something like that. So there was just no
priorities.
Yeah,
there was no escape. It is a little different now too. And I think as Boston sports fans, we've been incredibly spoiled with most of our teams winning championships and the Red Sox breaking the curse. And the fandom is still there, but it's not as fanatical, if that makes sense. So yes, there's still fights in the stands with the Yankees fans, but not as many. You're at the bar, it's more like, oh, you guys suck. No, you suck. Oh, okay, yeah. Grab a beer. It's not as like territorial, and you're not clenching your fists walking down Lansdowne Street.
Yeah, like the Yankees at the hands of the Red Sox, though, we have another death to discuss very briefly. My Instagram account has died a very very tragic death, unfortunately, under circumstances that are just like perfect for this podcast. I feel like I feel like I was texting you as I was watching.
You did Willy's
Wonderland.
It was almost real time, and that was your punishment for watching the movie, which I think the punishment fits the crime. That if you watch that and got through it and you were explaining it to me, the least they could do is deactivate your Instagram account.
Yeah, so for people who don't know, Willy's Wonderland is a movie with Nicolas Cage where he literally does not speak throughout the whole movie. And I don't really care about spoiling this movie because fuck Willy's Wonderland, because I don't have borderline Instagram account. I won't ruin the whole thing. But Nicolas Cage does not speak throughout the whole movie. You're like waiting for him to talk and it just never happens, right? And he gets locked into I don't even know how to describe it. It's like almost a Dave and Buster's-esque thing with animatronic animals.
Dave and Buster's in what sense? Is it like an arcade?
Like, yeah.
It's kind of like a museum-ish with points and tickets?
Yeah, like an arcade. It has like a funhouse kind of thing. Like, there's like a lot of different kind of vibes to it. There's just a lot kind of going on there. And I Instagram storied a video of Nicolas Cage like curb stomping the head of an animatronic bear, and then this movie's so ridiculous that it then has like oil splatter up in his face, as if it's like blood, like from, you know, Mandy or something like that. And I Instagram storied it, and then under 24 hours later, my account was disabled, basically. So the Willy's Wonderland people have gotten me, and I have to create a new Instagram account, unfortunately.
It's a sad way to go. And for people listening and following along when I'm here and Sam and our kind of antics, I feel like every time I text Sam about, hey, we're going to talk about these guys next week, or he shoots me an idea, he'll always follow up with some movie that he's watching, and I'm just like, how did you select that? Like, I'll go on Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, whatever, and there's so many times I'm like, I got nothing. Like, I'm just going to watch more preseason basketball or something. You always find something and describe it, and I'm in awe of your wonder and your search for all these movies. Like, I don't know if you're trying to find the end of the internet via movie or what it is, but it does amaze me.
Well, so a lot of the things that I end up watching are horror movies, because Laura is an enormous horror movie fan and has converted me into horror movies. And obviously a lot of those come out on like VOD, right? Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, earlier this week I was watching The Night House. Like, that had like a box office release. Do you know what The Night House is?
Is The Night House with, and I apologize for not knowing the actress's name, is that the actress that was in The Town? Was that the bank teller?
Rebecca Hall.
So I saw the picture of it, I scrolled by it, and then you actually said check it out. So that one like could make sense to me.
Yeah, but then like we'll also watch other stuff, like we watched The Wrong Turn remake, which was just abysmally like terrible. We watched like Willy's Wonderland, obviously, which was like, look, I'm a big fan of the genre Nicolas Cage getting a paycheck, and it's like legitimately a genre at this point, like movies where
I had a question for you on Nicolas Cage as I pull up IMDb here. It's like, what is, like, when did it make the turn for him that he says I'm going all in with this side of it? Because it's been like a decade, at least. But I'm scrolling. Like, was the turn after, like, was National Treasure just the turning point? He's like, yeah, I'm here.
So, like, that's a good question. When do I think? I think that, like, the VOD, like, slash, like, streaming boom, like, really kind of made the switch for him, because even, like, 2007, like, we have Ghost Rider, we have, like, the National Treasure sequel,
part two, right?
Yeah, 2009 is still like Bad Lieutenant, which is actually a good movie.
Bad Lieutenant is good.
Yeah, and then Kick-Ass in 2010. I think it was probably right after the Ghost Rider sequel, I would guess. Like right in that range, because then like in 2014 we start getting into Rage, which is some weird movie where he's holding what looks like a machete like behind his back on the movie poster. Outcast, which it looks like is a Chinese Canadian action movie. Left Behind, where there's a big fake flame behind him, like on the like poster. There's a movie called Pay the Ghost. I actually read the script for that while I was working at I don't know if I should say which movie studio. As an intern,
a movie studio.
And then like in 2018, I think it started to turn backward again, where these like VOD directors learned how to use him a little bit better and learned how to use the absurdity. Like in Mandy, he's really good. Then in Color Out of Space is like kind of an interesting movie. And then Pig this year is actually like amazing, to be honest. He's phenomenal. And it is like a, person who's down in his luck, just like living out in the woods by choice. But then like he did like this terrible Grand Isle movie with Kelsey Grammer early like last year, which was a nightmare. So I think it turned probably around like 2014. if we're kind of trying to pinpoint
it. And his titles have become so literal, too. Whatever the title is, like, that's exactly the movie. There's not a lot left for interpretation. That is what the movie is. And I think you watch every single one of them. Because no matter what, you say, hey, it's another Nicolas Cage movie. It's like, here we go again.
I don't watch all of them. Like, I haven't seen 2020's Jiu-Jitsu, despite the fact that it has both Nick Cage and Frank Grillo. Like, look, I'm a big Frank Grillo fan as much as any other action movie connoisseur. But yeah, haven't gotten to that one yet, let's say. I do watch a lot of them, though, which says a lot about me, doesn't it? There's a new one called Prisoners Out of Ghostland, where it looks like he has, like, samurai swords.
He's in Ghostland as prisoners, that's it.
the Wikipedia genre of Prisoners of Ghostland, it says, Prisoners of the Ghostland is a 2021 American weird Western action crime film. Whenever we've got five descriptive words on what kind of genre the movie is, and one of them is weird, you know that you're getting into something there.
They probably put some thought into that, too, through an intern, and, like, spice that up a little bit. Throw another word or two. Get another descriptor.
Oh, my God.
This weird fit.
Do you want to do the Many Saints of Newark thing now, or do you want to wait until the end?
Let's wait till the end so people don't jump ship and say, why am I driving to work and they're still talking about Nicolas Cage 17 minutes later?
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, we're here to talk about wings in the 2022 NBA draft. So, interesting crop of players for a number of reasons. I sent you a big list earlier this week of the guys that we want to talk about. We kind of split wings and forwards into a couple of different groups. What do you think of this wing class? Because I'm struggling with it a little bit in terms of overall talent.
Well, I looked at my notes, and we're doing wings today, and I'm assuming we'll do guards in the next week or two. When we're done, we'll have talked about here around 100 guys, which is good. I think we cover a lot. I've just sort of been underwhelmed at the depth, and maybe more underwhelmed at, like, the sure things. Like, how many first-round grades do you have on guys right now?
Oh, I doubt it's, God.
I mean, just roughly. It's not 35. It's not 42 like a couple years ago.
No. I think it's under 20 right now. To be honest,
it's under 20, and we've kind of talked about offline here. Hey, the wings are even less. There's a good handful of guys, and then there's space and opportunity for a bunch of other places to kind of seize that spot that hasn't been grasped yet. So there's a lot of names, but not a lot of wow names for me with this group, aside from the top three or four, say.
Yeah, and like, there are a couple guys that I think could really help the depth of this group, like, that we're talking about. And that is exciting to me that we're going to get to see potentially some of these. I don't even know about, like, question marks is fair, because I think a lot of these guys are NBA players long term. Like, we're going to talk about Bryce McGowan's today, right? We scheduled him for today as opposed to next week, right?
Yes.
So, like, we're going to talk about Bryce McGowan's. Like, I think there's a chance Bryce McGowan's is, like, a one and done who ends up being a top 20 pick. I think there's a chance Bryce McGowan's is, like, a guy who shoots under 40% this year, depending on how things go. Like, it's a total, he's a wild card to me. I think there are just a lot of wild cards in this NBA draft class in general. And kind of like you said, there are a lot of many fewer sure things than what I'm used to, certainly.
And it'll evolve in time, too, because I know the preseason's been two games, and people are either completely overjoyed or ready to fire their general manager based on said preseason games and stats, which, as a reminder, don't matter. We said the same thing about Summer League. Just we'll talk about the hot takes, but now I feel like the preseason's like even hotter takes, and throwing some veterans, and Cam Reddish is this, and Jalen, it's like, just relax. There's guys that will kind of pop up too. So my point is that Trey Murphy, I mean I knew who he was, but I didn't say, like, hey, first podcast we're talking about guys, let's talk about Trey Murphy and Josh Primo. Like, those guys have been really good, but I'd be lying if I said I knew it was going to happen throughout the year. A lot of these freshmen, it's going to take time. I mean, you mentioned Bryce McGowan's. Like, we're going to talk about other freshmen that, like, a guy like Harrison Ingram. Maybe he's one and done. Maybe he's there for 3 years. Just we got to see some actual game tape of college basketball before we get too far ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. So let's just jump in quick with the guy that I think is probably the biggest wild card in this 2022 NBA draft class, and it's AJ Griffin. And we probably could have popped AJ Griffin into the last, like, forwards podcast, but I wanted to save someone that is, like, really interesting for this podcast, to be honest. And I think AJ Griffin is absolutely, unequivocally the guy that is the swing player in this 2022 NBA draft class, because you could absolutely sell me that by the time January rolls around, we're talking about him as a top three pick. You could absolutely sell me that the last 18 months, where we haven't really seen him all that much because he got hurt in his junior year and then spent this past season rehabbing in Tampa with his father, Adrian Griffin, who is the lead assistant coach of the Toronto Raptors. You could sell me that, like, he hasn't gotten enough better, maybe is the way to put it, to where he's taken that leap. And, you know, maybe we're talking about a mid to late first round pick, right? I just don't know, because we haven't seen him in a highly competitive atmosphere. What I will say is, you go back and you watch his U16 tape at the FIBA Americas, he's awesome. He is a phenomenal player. You go back and you watch some of, like, the high school tape. You go back, you watch a little bit of the AAU that's out there. Like, very, very impressive player. But we just haven't seen him. Like, that's where this whole thing gets complicated. Like, we have not seen AJ Griffin enough to, like, really feel confident about placing him somewhere right now, right?
I don't. I mean, he's popped up on various boards anywhere from 7 to 17 to 25. I don't know where to slot him yet. I mean, he had a good, I think he played one session at UIBL the last year there before he got hurt, and he was hurt before that. And he took a little tumble in the high school rankings because of it, because those guys ranking, like, it's hard to project if you haven't seen other, like, him play versus other guys in the class who've gotten better, gotten worse. So I think, just to be safe, they pushed him down a few spots. I'm not mad at it. I'm drawn to what he can do, and it's telling that we said, I didn't know where to put him. Do we put him at three, put him at the four? He can play multiple positions.
Yeah.
And he's grown a little bit, and at the same time, he developed his game. And when he's healthy, he has real explosion and pop to the way he attacks. And it's more of an NBA game with him, with his footwork and with his angles to beat guys. He'll seal a guy and have a quick little fadeaway. He can make you pay when he's left open from deep. He has the bloodlines that he used to with his dad, and then also his mom ran track at Seton Hall. His brother, Alan, plays at Syracuse. His sister plays basketball at UConn. So he grew up around the game, and there's a reason he has so much polish at a young age. And being in New York, I think you're automatically overhyped just because that's just the way things go there. And when I first saw him as a freshman and sophomore, I was like, nah, I don't know, maybe. And then we kind of, like, got healthier and a little bit more sure of himself junior year. I said, wow, I see it here. So there's trick-or-treat watching him in high school. There's games he looks like a lottery pick, and others he looks like he would come off the bench for, like, a Big East team. So I don't know which AJ Griffin we're going to get. I think it'll help him playing alongside the guys that he will be this college season, and he'll have the opportunity to kind of solidify himself as a top five guy. But yeah, it's far from unfinished for me.
Yeah, I mean, 6'6".
He is unfinished.
Yeah, totally. 6'6" with, damn near a 7-foot wingspan, right? Like, if it's not 7 foot, it's 6'10½, 6'11½, something like that. Legitimately looks like an NBA wing, probably more than any other player in this class. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I don't know who tweeted at you, but the last pod somebody wrote, when are you writing about AJ Griffin? The dude looks like a superhero. He does. Like, he has a chiseled, long, forward-ish frame where it's, I don't know if he's a three or four on the court, but it doesn't really matter because he looks like he has the wherewithal to play those both spots.
Yeah, totally. So, look, we're talking about a guy that could be a top three pick here, and I feel like we've kind of exhausted what we should say about him, if only because, again, like, it's just an uncertain situation, with AJ, and I don't want to like overhype. I don't want to underhype. I think that there are just so many different avenues that could play themselves out over the course of the next year that I don't really want to like throw specific things out there on him. Like you said, I think he has a chance to be a real shooter. I actually kind of like the way he gets into his pull-up game as well. He can hurt you from deep just off the catch. Like, he has all of the tools. I just need to see more of like the glue. Like, what does he look like as a ball handler against high pressure, against guys who are as big as he is, against guys who can cut off his drives and like make him present a counter move? These are just questions we don't know the answer to. I don't know if he can do it. I don't know if he can't do it. There's just a lot that we don't know right now, I think.
And I don't know if we mentioned this. He's going to Duke. So he'll be playing next to Paolo Banchero, who's in discussion for the top pick in the draft. I am fascinated to see what that relationship basketball-wise looks like. I have too much time on my hands in terms of trying to find basketball tape, and Duke posted like 9 minutes of baskets of like an open scrimmage to a social media account, and I'm like kind of like scouring, like, I think that was AJ Griffin basket, but he's not really cutting much here. So I need to see full games. I think it'll be a fun watch with him and Paolo to potentially battle out for those top three-ish picks.
And now that we're past AJ Griffin, like, we're into total wild card territory now.
In terms of, I'm scrolling at that. Yes, I mean he's pretty wild, but yeah, there's I'd say more wild cards. Just not a ton of separation right here, right now.
Well, I'm saying like I think AJ Griffin's like definitely the best talent among these wings.
Sure.
Once you get past him, so like the next guy we have listed here is Ben Mathurin. Like,
yep.
I think Ben Mathurin can dribble a little bit. I don't know if he can dribble on an NBA court right now. Like, yeah. You know, the next guy here is like Peyton Watson, right? Like, Peyton Watson's very skinny. I have questions about how it's going to look at UCLA this year. Dyson Daniels, like, I have questions about the jump shot. Marcus Bagley, I have questions, you know, kind of similarly to AJ Griffin. He was a guy last year that people hadn't seen a ton of over the course of the last couple of years. So this is where we start getting into wild card territory, I think. And I just want
to
like
a lot of the evals are similar to everything you're saying. A lot of the guys right. Like, well, can he shoot? Kinda. Can he dribble a little bit? Well, you need those skills as a wing in the NBA. It's kind of non-negotiables.
Right, but also wing is by far the position that NBA teams are looking for most right now in terms of like depth players. So a lot of these guys are going to go in the first round. It's just right. We don't know which ones necessarily. We don't know which ones are going to prove themselves as being worth that. We don't know. Like, we have a good sense. Like, I have a pretty good sense of having watched tape, and like, we're going to evaluate these guys. But this is really the wild card group of the 2022 class. So let's take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to dive into some of these names here that I think are pretty fun. Okay, we're back. Let's start with Ben Mathurin. He is a 6'6" wing out of Canada, has like a 6'10" wingspan, 6'9", 6'10". Went to Arizona last year, was a really good 3-and-D player for the Wildcats, considered going through to the NBA draft after one season. I think probably would have been selected somewhere in the top 40 had he done that, but ultimately decided to stay at Arizona for his sophomore year. He'll play under new coach there, Tommy Lloyd. And it's an interesting skill set because he's a legit 40% three-point shooter right now, I think. And he is accountable defensively, I would say. I wouldn't go as far as like disruptive defensively, but he's very accountable. He's long. He can defend multiple positions. I think he's just kind of a 3-and-D guy right now. And while that has value in today's NBA, and he has real NBA athleticism, I think there's still kind of a lot to work out in terms of the rest of his game.
I do want to give him credit for a lot of guys will declare for the draft, say they go back to school and they haven't necessarily worked in their game, or you don't really show. His stuff has been very forward-facing. So his offseason, he went to camp with the Canadian national team. It doesn't make that team, so he ends up playing the U19 team to capture the bronze medal. He scores 30 or more points twice in that FIBA tournament. He's added 15 pounds of muscle per the Tucson Journal, so he was listed at 195. Now he's up to 210 pounds on the website. Great. Hitting the weight room. I want some development to his mid-range game as well. He shot the three. He was 38 for 91 last year. He can finish some by the rim, but what else can he do? He doesn't really shoot well on the move. He doesn't really have a floater. You have to keep the defense guessing and not have them settle in, knowing if he's run off the line, he's going to try to throw himself in the paint and the handle's not the tightest. The FIBA stuff, I will say.
You think he can't really shoot on the move right now?
Well, I mean, my next point was he did pull up from 15 feet a lot more this summer in the U19s. He did. Mm-hmm. So I feel like he's taking the criticism or the constructive criticism and feedback he got during the kind of early draftish process and then trying to put that into practice. Similar to that, though, I also want him to facilitate a little bit more and keep like some continuity offensively when he isn't scoring. Only around one assist per game. And not view as a threat to find that open man. If he's coming off a high ball screen, like he's looking to shoot, and everyone kind of knows it, and Arizona's going to need him to score and to self-create, and he's not in this position this season to stand in the corner with his hands up and hoping he gets the ball reversed, which he did a lot last year. So he's going to have to take more of a leadership stake, I'd say. The opportunity's there with him and Tubelis, and he's going to be able to explore his offensive repertoire, but during the research of this for him, because I am very intrigued by him as a prospect, I saw a Tommy Lloyd interview with Ben Pasco, and he said, regarding Ben Mathurin, he said, he has a ton of potential. He's an awesome kid. He is maybe a little bit inconsistent. I think for him, he's going to find ways to utilize his abilities in other areas of the game, whether that's offensive rebounding for a putback, running for an easy layup, back cutting for a layup. So he's not just relying on somebody passing the ball and him shooting a three. I think this kid has so many ways he can contribute. I said, that's perfect. I don't need to say anything else. Like, his head coach gets it. I think that's what we all see as kind of draft evaluators. Like, he just needs to take that next step.
Yeah, and Tommy's really smart with that stuff. Anyone who's spoken to Tommy Lloyd before just kind of understands that I think Tommy will get the most out of Ben Mathurin in a pretty real way, because he has experience dealing with NBA prospect wings. I mean, he just coached Corey Kispert last year, for instance, right? And Corey Kispert developed into one of the better cutters, one of the better transition runners as well. Yeah. No one scored more transition points last year in college basketball than Corey Kispert. So I think that Tommy will know how to get the most out of what Ben Mathurin's skill set is. Now, this is where things get a little bit tricky, because I actually do think that Mathurin can shoot on the move coming off of screens. Like, I think that he can like take a pin down or take like a flare screen, stops at his feet and shoot. But I also agree with you that we haven't seen quite enough of the off the bounce game yet, in terms of like, okay, guy closes out heavy, can he relocate into like a one dribble pull up? Can he relocate into like a two dribble, you know, elbow jumper in order to try and take advantage of just what the defense presents him? And on top of it, I'm really glad you brought up the passing, because that to me is like the number one kind of concern for me. I don't know that he sees the floor all that well in terms of making like damaging, difficult passes. It seems to me, you know, just kind of watching him, that it's either I'm going to catch and shoot, I'm going to catch and try and like curl, or maybe take a dribble, even though it'll be like a preordained dribble. Or I'm just going to make like an escape pass kind of thing, as opposed to trying to draw defenders toward me. And that's fine. Like, he's young, it'll take time, but, that's kind of where I'm at. Like, he's a good player.
He's an easy out offensively right now. The Corey Kispert thing is a great point, because Corey Kispert is one of these movement shooters, and you're not going to shoot it like him. I don't think so. But he was as dangerous as a cutter hitting, going away from the ball. Timmy finds him here. Like, you didn't know where that guy was going to be. If you leave Ben Mathurin, at least last season, if you left him in the corner, if the ball's on the other side of the court, you can go and help side, and he's still going to be in that corner. He's not one of these guys like sneaks behind the zone or like you know, there's a back cut, you're overplayed. Like, he was just kind of one-dimensional in that sense, in that he's right where you left him. He'll catch it. He can hit a three, but, like, everything else needs to just be expanded upon.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Okay. Well, let's go to the next guy here. Is I want to talk about Peyton Watson next. Let's just, like, stay in the Pac-12. I've seen Peyton Watson probably – how much have you seen Peyton Watson? So that's a good question.
Where is he, at Poly High School in California? A couple of those games, and that's really about it. He didn't have, like, a ton of tape out there, so just that and some all-star stuff.
Yeah,
so I'd say less than five full games for sure.
Yeah, so I've seen right around the same as that, like probably five or six full games. And I was a little bit more hesitant on him, I guess. And it's worth saying that I have seen five or six games since he took the leap as well, because Peyton Watson was not necessarily considered a potential one and done prospect. I would say up until when would you say, like right before his,
say like, junior-ish yeah, year, gonna say like you're making that term, because he was 6 foot
right before
two,
the summer and, before his junior year,
and he sprouted from 6'2 to 6'8 in a year without losing his guard skills, and that's when people did like the double look, like, oh man, like this might be something.
Right. So really, really interesting player insofar as you're right that he hasn't lost his guard skills. Right. The thing that offensively impresses me most about Peyton Watson is the vision. He's a really, really good passer for someone who is 6'8". He also understands how to draw defenders toward him and then make passing reads off of that. Like, he is a damaging passer. He's not just like a quick read, you know, catch and then, you know, fire passer. He actually knows how to react to what a defense is presenting to him. He's just very skinny, and he's playing at UCLA this year under Mick Cronin, and I think he's probably actually going to be fine playing for Cronin, because I've liked what I've seen from him defensively quite a bit, actually. Like, I think he's very conscientious defensively. Like, he knows where to be, and he gives a lot of effort, and I think Cronin will really appreciate that, and I think Cronin, under certain circumstances, you know, may kind of chew up and spit out some freshmen. I don't really think that'll happen with Peyton Watson. Having said that, Peyton Watson is also entering a UCLA team that has both Jaime Jaquez and Johnny Juzang, who we're going to talk about here. Honestly, maybe right as soon as we're done talking about
next.
Peyton Watson. Yeah.
Right.
They have Jules Bernard and David Singleton, both of whom are four-year guys at UCLA. They have Jalen Clark, who I actually really liked at the end of last year. I thought was showcasing some very real talent. It seemed like a Mick Cronin kind of guy in terms of the way that he was very aggressive defensively. They have a bit more depth on the interior this year than what they had last year. Like, Cody Riley and Miles Johnson are actually two centers. And I wouldn't be stunned if they try to play Cody Riley at the four occasionally. I wouldn't recommend that necessarily, but I think Miles Johnson should just start at center. I think he's one of the best defensive centers in the country. Having said that, they also have Mac Etienne, you know, coming off of a, I guess, let's say, a trial by fire freshman season, because he got there midseason.
And they threw him in that fire, man. I mean, he was playing meaningful minutes in the tournament. He had to.
Yep, totally. So, look, Mac Etienne's a guy that was like a four-star recruit, and I think that they actually have good interior depth this year. They have great wing depth because they have four guys that, you know, can actually play on the wing, which is, you know, five guys really that can actually play on the wing without accounting for Watson, which is more than any other team in college basketball probably. Then on top of it, they have a great point guard in Tiger Campbell. So I just worry about what the role is for Peyton Watson. Peyton Watson's a great prospect, and he's a great long-term prospect that I think is definitely going to play in the NBA long-term. And I think he's going to play in the NBA for a long time once he gets his jumper figured out. But if he's not shooting on a certain day, like, I think there's just a real chance Peyton Watson plays like 20 minutes a night at UCLA, basically.
No question. They return their whole starting five, add Miles Johnson. Like, did you even say Kenneth Wuba? who like played like a lot of minutes. Like, I don't want to say he won some of those games of the tournament, but there's foul trouble. He stepped in. So there is a log jam of playing time. And in a vacuum, you might look at him as a prospect and say, no doubt, one and done. The role, it just may be different. Like, I don't anticipate him starting. I'd be surprised if he starts. Can that change during the year? Sure. And there's a lot of things that he does that are different from the pieces that they have. 6'9", kind of is 3'4", runs and finishes, knows how to use his length around the basket, gets by his man at the first step. The jumper does scare me a little bit, just he overthinks it when he's left open. And watching, he was on that Team USA U19 team, he was pushed all over the place. I mean, he needs more size and strength, and I don't necessarily fault him for it. And I like the fit of him playing with Jaime Jaquez and Johnny Juzang, just two more floor spacers that allows him to be more of a slasher finisher. Like, he doesn't have to be a shooter. If he's just a slasher finisher, gets up and down, shows enough things, the jumper, like, we'll get there. I don't think NBA scouts will be super hung up on it, but yeah, it will be hard to find significant minutes on a team that's loaded and frankly has really high expectations. You make this unbelievable Final Four run out of nowhere, and now we're going to bring everybody back at a five-star guy and one of the most sought-after center transfers in the country, Miles Johnson. There's a lot there.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been pretty transparent that I have a future on UCLA to win the title, like 18-1. Like, I think UCLA is going to be awesome.
When did you put that bet down? 18-1 seems outrageous. That seems high.
Yeah, it was probably in June, I would say.
Wow.
Sometime like June.
My guess would be like 10-1, 12-1.
Yeah, so our good friends at BetMGM have already reduced that number down to 12-1. They're actually the third favorite to win the title. Whereas when I got them, they were more in like the top 16 as opposed to like third favorite to win the title. Like Purdue, right? I have Purdue at like 17-1. I have Texas at like, 20-1 or something like that. So basically, like, those are the three teams that I'm pretty invested in this year in terms of their success. All three of those right now, according to our good friends at BetMGM, the sportsbook partner of The Athletic, all three of those teams are now in the top 10 in terms of title future. And I don't think any of them were whenever I got the bet. So I am generally, I would say, generally just intrigued with how this Peyton Watson thing goes, because I think Jaime Jaquez is phenomenal. Like, I think he is I think he is probably going to win Pac-12 Player of the Year this year. I'm just calling that shot now. I know that his teammate is probably the favorite to win that award. Johnny Juzang is also phenomenal and very much should be considered for that honor. But Jaime Jaquez averaged 12 points and 6 rebounds last year. He shot 39% from 3 and 49% from the field. He's tough as shit. He's a great defender that made the All-Pac-12 defensive team. Like, I think he brings more to the table that NBA teams are looking for than Johnny Juzang does, who is just like a super high-level shooter right now.
And just to finish the Peyton Watson thing as we transition to these guys, my shot that I'm calling is, if Peyton Watson is a one and done, it's going to be on people seeing for the future and the upside, not because he averages 18 points per game as Pac-12 Player of the Year. I just don't envision that with what the roster is. I really like Jaime Jaquez too, and people around the UCLA program will tell you he's the best player on the team, and it's not close. I've heard that from multiple people. Just an incredible NCAA run. I mean, despite the Juzang spurt, I'm still counting on Jaime to be the guy. And some of the box score is ridiculous. 27 points on playing game versus Michigan State, 19 in the elimination game versus Gonzaga. Similar volume of threes his freshman sophomore year. It was under 100 per season, and he still bumped his percentage up from 31 to 39%. Like, as an isolation scorer, he's a good jump shooter. Not great out of pick and roll. Yeah. Going back now, and I get so emotional watching the tournament, and I have to be better at looking it through an evaluator, not just somebody enjoying the game, is that he makes some really tough shots.
Yeah.
So he has some of that, like, poor man's college Adam Morrison to him with, like, the flair, the passion, the showmaking. I'm not saying he's going to average 28 points per game, but he does have that fearlessness to him, and he goes so hard when he's in attack mode, and he'll hit these back-breaking daggers during that Final Four run. I just want him to take care of the ball a little bit more. Can be loose when he gets in hero mode. There's going back again and watching it. There were some oh boys, and Gonzaga did a great job in that game. So they just wore him down. They double teamed him. They swarmed him to paint once he put the ball on the ground. So I'm nitpicking here. I like him. I'm hesitant because of the guys that kind of have the similar frame and type of game that they don't necessarily always pan out in the NBA. So that's why I'm just a little slow to say he's a definitive lock first rounder like some people have right now.
Yeah, no, I don't think he's a lock first rounder, if only because the athleticism is a real concern in his case. Like, he's just not a super athlete in the way that a lot of NBA wings are. I think he needs to be like the super high level shooter that we've seen that he's capable of being throughout the course of his career thus far. I'm like trying to think of a guy, like, immediately for some reason my mind went to Robbie Hummel, but Hummel was just like a way better passer than what Jaquez has ever shown. He's a little bit bigger. Like, it's just like trying to like find, it's hard to find the guy that Jaime Jaquez is like most like in the NBA, but it's like, not, I don't know why my mind went to Hummel initially, but it's not even that.
Right, and he was, I'm just looking up quickly here, he was the 58th overall pick,
right? Yeah, no,
he in the draft, like, and played what, a couple years. I know he had injuries and whatnot, but it didn't pan out, didn't work.
Robbie played in the NBA for a while. Like, I think it worked enough.
And still playing 3-on-3, still doing his thing there. Gotta give him credit where credit's due.
Yeah, like, I think it was more that the injuries just like kind of took a lot from him, unfortunately. But let's talk about Johnny Juzang now. Johnny Juzang was just on fire the entire NCAA tournament. Yes. I mean, we just talked about contested shot making with Jaime Jaquez. Like, Johnny Juzang's contested shot making was absolutely unbelievable.
He had the NBA Jam fireball for a tournament. It's like he blacked out in March and became the super version of Johnny Juzang. And I saw the combine and I'm like, oh, that's Johnny Juzang. Or is it? Or is the tournament version Johnny Juzang? Which Johnny Juzang are we getting here this year?
So like, here's the thing with Johnny. It was happening before the NCAA tournament. So the NCAA tournament that he played was what, 6 games probably, because they didn't make the title game. So 6 games. If you go back through his final 17 games of the 2021 season, I guess, he averaged 19 points, 5 rebounds, and 2 assists, and shot 46 from the field and 37 from 3 on like nearly 7 attempts per game. Like, he was really good for a long time. He wasn't just really good and got hot for a 6-game stretch. The biggest thing is, like, I just don't know what you do with him on defense, to be honest. I just don't know that I see the athleticism there to where he can really hold up the point of attack. He's going to have to get stronger. He's going to have to, like, just really be very physical, I feel like. But man, like, the jumper is going to give him a real shot, and the contested shot making is going to give him a real shot. Like, that's a guy where I almost don't care what the percentages say. We know that dude can shoot, right? Like, it's just that he takes a lot of contested ones.
There is, but despite that 17-game run, he still only shot 35% from 3 during the year. Like, that's not a wowzer number as a shooter. Like, if I'm drafting a guy who's a shooter, I want him to be more than 35% from the college line. He does shoot a clean ball coming out of his hand. I think he's probably more of like a 38 or so guy next season. But if the shot's not falling, is he able to turn the corner and come off these high ball screens? Is he able to read the defense and kick to the perimeter when the defense collapses? And it's just, my other point of question is, will he be comfortable creating his own looks with 2 to 3 dribbles as opposed to 8? I mean, that tournament run allowed him to kind of clear out and make a bunch of dribble moves or turn his back to 3-point line and do like that old school Mark Jackson back you down thing. For his game and position in the NBA, and likely his role, that's just not a translatable way to do it. And as much as the tournament and that last run has burned to my head, still the combine is too, where all that shot creation and shot making was just sort of gone when the NBA spotlight was on him.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. The combine stuff, especially when he was up against real athletes all the time, all across the court, like that's a real thing that he has to address for sure. I will say, in terms of the numbers on his three-point shot, he took just as many jumpers off the dribble as he did off the catch last year. I think that if you would change that percentage in some way, and by the way, like, as a general rule of thumb, most catch and shoot jumpers for people tend to be unguarded catch and shoot jumpers, just because, well, most of them are pretty clean looks, right? Like, that's when you take catch yep. and shoot threes, right? You find the guy who where his help defender has sunk too far in, you kick it out to him, and he's getting a clean look, right? Actually, 52% of Johnny Juzang's jumpers off the catch last year were guarded. And in terms of just jumpers off the dribble, he took over half of his shots off the dribble. So it's just like a tricky thing for me to try and navigate, right? Because the numbers are lower, but I think that the context for those numbers in terms of the way that, like, what the shot distribution is, I think is actually also, like, very relevant in his case, because he was just asked to shoulder everything for that offense a lot of the time.
He was, him or Jaquez, depending on who had the hotter hand, and we don't have to talk about the hot hand fallacy, but the offensive load fell on those guys. It wasn't Tyre Campbell had a game or two here or there, but those guys, they're going kind of to the strengths of higher wings were going to score. And not offensively, Cody Riley also had a few good games there too, but I wasn't being like, well, the swing is going to be Cody Riley. It's going to be, no, is Johnny Juzang going to have 27 points this game and keep him in it and keep it close down to the wire?
Yeah. All right. We don't want to go for hours upon hours on this show. I have Jaquez and Juzang as like potential first round picks. Let's talk about Dyson Daniels now. Interesting prospect out of Australia, decided not to do the NBL Next Stars route and instead come to do the G League Ignite program, which was an interesting choice, I thought. I actually quite like Dyson Daniels for similar reasons to why I like Peyton Watson. I think they're actually pretty comparable prospects, just Peyton's a little bit bigger. Daniels is a really good on-ball defender. He's a really attentive off-ball defender from what I've seen. He makes plays. He's disruptive with his hands at a very high level. He's also a really good passer. Like, he was the guy that was often initiating for the Australian team this summer at the U19s and really showcased a lot of like high level distribution ability for a player that will be asked to play more of a secondary role. The big question is the jumper. I think the mechanics look good. He just doesn't quite get enough like lower half involvement in the shot. But I think he's going to be pretty good. Like, I think he is going to be a first round pick.
Pretty good. And I watched a lot of that U19 film too. 14-5-5 for Australia during that tournament. Runs the court, stays really wide. That popped to me. He changes ends really quickly. He cuts, he moves, he dives away from the ball. He is the sneaky scorer that we want Ben Mathurin to be, hiding behind his man or the backside of the zone, then popping up for an easy shot. Thought the form of the jumper was pretty compact as like a set shot when the ball was swung to him. There is a slight dip and some crank to it. Can be a zone buster when the defense doesn't close out and has time to get that crank going. I liked he could finish with either hand around the rim. He had good bounce and body control, good length. Handle a little shaky too. I saw a couple turnovers, a couple turns his back, deflections. It just didn't pop initially and seemed to be more of a complimentary piece to me. Steady player, 2-1 assist to turnover ratio, and not necessarily going to hurt you out there. I know these aren't like the most like energetic type of compliments or attributes, but he just didn't have like the... I heard the buzz, and I watched, and I think my eyes were excited for like these big time plays, and just not necessarily always going to come with Dyson Daniels.
Yeah, no, I agree for sure. I like definitely more of like a workman's game almost, like right. the way that he just like generates offense off the ball and the way he defends and can make some passes. Like he tries to get to like his step back for three. He just isn't a good enough shooter yet to like consistently take advantage of that. I think that's the swing skill. If Dyson Daniels is a shooter, he's going to play in the NBA for like a decade and be like a really good rotation wing. If he's not, then things get questionable for him in a hurry, I think. And it all just comes down to being able to knock down consistent shots for him.
Yeah, this is a home game for you with the Australian thing. So if anyone has the right intel or eval, it's, I hope you at least have a head start here, which sounds like you do.
Let's take another quick commercial break, and then we'll dive into three freshmen, maybe even a fourth, that I'm actually like really interested in, especially one of whom that I think like is a legit, real, like potential top 20 pick. Okay, we're back. So there's a group of four freshmen that I think are like swing guys in this class. I've like pretty much convinced myself that I think Max Christie is going to be a first round pick, one and done guy, basically. I know he's not like on too many like other people's mock drafts. Like he's going to be a top 20 guy for me entering this year. He is everything that NBA teams are kind of looking for, I think. Like he's 6'7". He has beautiful shooting mechanics. He is at least reliable defensively. He's not disruptive defensively in like a difference making way, but he knows where to be and is like very useful. I'm just generally very, very in on his game because I think he actually knows how to play basketball, knows how to like come off of screens, knows how to get separation. You've told me you're a little bit lower on the handle. Like, I think it's a functional handle. I don't think it's like a super creative handle. He reminds me a lot of Moses Moody last year, though, like in a lot of ways.
The handle is functional for the role that he plays. And I've seen him a ton because he grew up in the Illinois Wolves program system on Under Armour Association. So I've watched a lot of Max Christie for many years. And he does have great size as a 2, a 3, and a point guard and a pinch at 6'6", 6'7". Really effective in using his length to finish too. Whether it's like these short fadeaways, these step backs, he'll drive in the paint, he'll mix it up for some rebounds. He's put on he's still skinny, but he's put on some size, noticeably so, at the end of his senior year and the stuff we've kind of seen from Michigan State to start the preseason. Just a lot of balance to his game. Limited motion on his jumper. He's made that more compact too. My only sort of hesitation is that he was such a cheat code in high school that he could do whatever he wanted and score 30 points a game because of the league he played. So he had this longer leash to make mistakes and take these offensive chances. And it's funny because he's used to getting away with taking these wild shots. And you have to see how on board Tom Izzo is with that. And I looked, they had an inter-squad scrimmage this weekend at Michigan State, and the brief notes I read about it was it seemed like the two were kind of still feeling each other out. Like, he took a couple wild ones, and Izzo's like, do you live with it? Do you pull them? Do you yell at them? You don't want to crush the kid as a freshman, but he also still has a specific style that he coaches and the way that he wants to play that he's not going to be able to take as wild shots as he has at the high school level.
Yeah, no, I totally get all of that, and I think that that's all 100% right. And there is a chance that, like, it just doesn't go as well as what I want it to, for sure. Like, but it's just kind of what every NBA team is looking for at the end of the day. Yeah, that's kind of what I keep coming back to.
And I anticipate him starting, and I think that's a fair shot for you to shoot, though. You're not saying Max Christie. It's Banchero, there's Chet Holmgren, Jaden Hardy's fourth. You're not saying anything extreme like that. But, hey, he could be in consideration to be a first-round guy and climb his way up with a few solid performances. Going to take his freshman lumps. He's going to have to adjust to the college game and playing a little bit more within himself, but very smart kid, hard worker. He has all the things that the characteristics you look for in that role and that type of player in the NBA.
Okay. Bryce McGowan's is next, 6'7", almost like combo guard more than wing right now. Would you agree?
Yes, I would.
Just big, though. And I kind of mentioned at the top of the podcast that I think he's another like real swing guy, because I could see a world where under that Fred Hoiberg wide open offensive style, they have some shooters as well on that Nebraska roster this year, that it just looks really good. And he averages like 16, 6, and 3 assists per game and is like a very clear one and done that's like a top 20 pick. Or I could see a world where he averages like 15 points a game and shoots 38% from the field, and it doesn't quite look as good as what the counting numbers say, because he just has some problems with efficiency from time to time. He's about 175 pounds at 6'7". Ballpark it there.
Yeah. People who have seen practice the last couple weeks said he's a little bit bigger, but still very slender.
Yeah, very, very slender guy. And plays a brand of basketball that is completely fearless. He is the person initiating contact. His father, if I remember correctly, is a football player, or was a football player at, is it Clemson? It's something
sure. I'm with the brother's background, but that would explain the mentality, his attacking mentality, if you will.
Yeah, so like completely fearless, really like initiates contact, doesn't just absorb contact, actually struggles to absorb it right now because he is so skinny throughout his core and like just doesn't have that strength yet. But like he plays with a level of toughness that I really like to see from a potential shot creating, you know, scoring styled player. I like the jumper mechanics. He just has a natural bend and doesn't have enough lower half involvement. Like the release is very clean and he gets good rotation on the ball. I think it's just going to take a little bit of time. And the question is just like, does it happen this year for Bryce McGowan's, or does it happen next year, 2 years? I don't know, but I think he's definitely an NBA player long term. It's just what, when does it happen basically to where it's most valuable for him to be, you know, to go through to the NBA draft, I guess.
Yeah, at 6'6", a high level athlete. He was a top 25 recruit, 5-star across most recruiting services. And it was also a nice game of chess by the Nebraska staff. His brother, Trey, was at Pitt, transfers to Nebraska. Bryce was actually one time committed to Florida State, decommits, and commits to the Huskers for once a lifetime opportunity to play with his brother. Very smart. He had two for the price of one. I don't mean that literally. So he pushes the ball ahead really well too, to cover ground, and can make his own offense off the dribble. Similar to you, I really like his body control, and he is a capable shooter from distance, and he believes in it. You can see he has confidence when he releases the ball, and the way he gets up and down the court and plays through contact, that pops out. The strength is obviously a huge swing, but he needs it. He could probably speed up his jumper a little bit playing in that Fred Hoiberg system style that we watched last year, and we saw how much offensive flexibility they gave a guy like Delano Banton and different players. But it was kind of like, here's the ball, go like do your thing, work on defense. Yep. And then you can explore offensively what you want to do. And I know that part of the appeal for Bryce, aside from playing with his brother, was there's minutes night one for you to come in and score and be a high-level guy and really showcase the NBA teams what your ability is.
I think that's definitely right. We'll just see how it goes. Like, I think that it could go one of two ways, and one of those ways is exceptionally positive. One of them is it just is a bit inefficient this year, and he's a sophomore at Nebraska, and, you know, he goes in the first round next year. Right. Mm-hmm. At some point, the switch is going to flip, though. Like, once he figures out efficiency, it's going to be real and he's going to be awesome, I think.
Yeah. The motherboard that we have currently for like guys that need to flip the switch that we're talking about today is massive. He's one of them. If the switch is flipped, that I think it could happen sooner rather than later than some of these other guys.
Yeah, I agree. The next freshman for me is Matthew Cleveland.
Yes.
Great scorer in high school, like has a lot of just great. He's phenomenal footwork. I think that's the number one thing that really stood out to me. Like on his drives, he knows exactly where to place his feet. Has like a nice little Euro step game occasionally, and like can really just knows how to get into spaces in order to get a pull up jumper off or to get a shot at the rim off. I think he's definitely a potential one and done. I don't love the like athleticism in a lot of ways. Like he doesn't seem to have a crazy amount of explosiveness laterally and like on the ground. He can jump a little bit for sure.
He can jump.
Mm. Yeah. But like on the ground, it doesn't function quite in the same way, it seems like. But maybe it just works at Florida State and he averages 14 points a game in that like very spread production wise offense, and he's really good.
He's an up and down wing, and he will convert in transition. It will be he's a guy that I want to see how it works at Florida State, because Coach Hamilton has been great in producing these first round picks that go in and you don't really know what you're getting. Like even Patrick Williams, like it kind of took a little bit of a leap of faith, and Scotty Barnes went really high, and it's been one preseason game, and I want to contradict myself, but he showed more stuff in one game, preseason game with the Raptors, than you kind of saw the whole time at Florida State, because the floor was more spaced out. He played more than 22 minutes. Like, so Matthew Cleveland could be a byproduct of that. The confidence he plays for, and I think that the lateral stuff I agree with, but he'll search for guys to try to dunk on now too. And yeah. And he'll adjust his body around traffic, like you said, at Euro step or coming off screens, he'll finish in the paint. He'll settle sometimes for step backs and turnarounds off the dribble. And he has to just round out his game in the half court. He's such a full court guy that he wants an up tempo style. He wants guys playing fast because he's great attacking, whether it's a shifting defense in transition or shifting defense off of ball reversals for a slow recovering guy or defender. And he'll win those battles with baseline with rip-throughs or take up the lane and go back door. I just want to see how he is in a half-court structured offense where you're not just going to run up and down and beat somebody up the court.
The attack portion of what you just said is a really good point. Like, he knows exactly when he has a seam and exploits it. Like, he's constantly looking for that little advantage, and once he sees it, boom, like he hits it as quickly as possible. What have you thought of his defense? Because I don't really have a great feel for it yet.
No, not great feel, because like we said, so much of the high school tape is lazy, and it's not just him specifically, but it's just reach-ins for steals, for deflection. You start kind of creeping out to half court to get out for a dunk so much so often in games that I don't think I've had like a real full read on what it would look like for him in a 40-minute game.
Yeah, I'm just not real sure yet. That'll be like the biggest key to him getting on the floor, to be honest, is being able to play defense at a high level, because yeah, Leonard Hamilton will not play him if he's not willing to defend. I know that like some of the scouting reports from people who have seen him more than I have said like they believe in him being able to be like a good defender at some point.
Oh,
it's
too.
Just, yeah, I don't know where he is right now, I think is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, it's still... when I see him as high as he is on draft stuff, I'm not like negative toward it, but I just have more caution because I don't know what the whole thing is going to look like.
Okay.
He has to shoot it,
and I think that that's also a pretty real question for him. Can he consistently knock down catch and shoot shots? But we'll see. I have some faith in him being a shooter long term. It's just not right now. And then the last guy who's a freshman,
hold on, real quick, just made me laugh thinking about it, is that about shooting and defending. I think someone came at you at Twitter today and said you couldn't guard Imani Bates, so those type of jump shots and defensive stuff will develop and evolve as we go along here too.
Yeah, we'll talk about Imani in a minute. So the last freshman I want to talk about is Harrison Ingram, who's going to go to Stanford. Really good physical frame, just 6'6", 6'7", with like a 6'11", 7-foot wingspan. Not a crazy athlete by any stretch of the imagination, but does have like some pretty real talent for scoring the basketball. A very conscientious defender, again, like a guy who really gives effort on that end. And at least I would say probably a better baseline off the catch and shoot than where I would say Matthew Cleveland is. Would you agree?
Yes.
The question is just really athleticism. Like, I'm not totally sure what to do with him in terms of where he is athletically.
I had the same exact conversation with a person on the West Coast because he has a chance. He sees the game really, really well, exceptionally well. And coming in, he could be one of the better classers in that entire – better passers in that entire class. I'm sorry. He is more of a power driver that uses body, shoulders to initiate contact for space creating. And then he'll utilize those pauses, hesitation dribbles, but it's never that burst. He like has to freeze his man to still beat him with a step, and it's like an extra shoulder there because he doesn't have a ton of wiggle, but he does have that craftiness beyond being a straight line driver. And he's smart. He was. I feel like everyone's on this USA U19 team, but when he was there, he played the middle of the zone. He passed. He moved. He face cut his man. Along those same lines, he does have very active hands on defense for steals and deflections too. So it's like his mind is faster than his body. The foot speed and lateral quickness, it may be an issue. It could improve. His body has leaned out some since he got to campus. The shot isn't bad, just a little flat at times. And again, it's fixable. And Stanford's been on a hot streak with prospects developmentally, even more so. I could sneaky see him creeping up too because I do like his skill set. Foot speed always scares me as a thing defensively to get there in the NBA. And it's a big thing to just say, yeah, you got to fix your feet. But he does a lot of things really well.
Okay. And then the last little group we're going to talk about here are the returners. So Marcus Bagley, I think, probably would have been a top 50 pick in the 2021 draft, decided to go back to Arizona State. With him, just needs to continue to prove that he's a consistent 35% to 40% three-point shooter, has real defensive properties, and continues to be a high-level defender. And I would just like to see him expand his game a little bit more as a ball handler.
Right. And we also have to remember that last year in Arizona State, he did play with kind of more ball stoppers than Remy Martin and Josh Christopher. So there were a lot of times where I felt that he felt when he caught it, there was pressure for him to force an attempt or he was going to get the ball back for a half dozen possessions. So you get sped up. He only played, 12 games because of injury. So it's hard to project. But the measurements, the combine, you're almost 6'8" with a 6'11" wingspan. Just need to see more, do more. More steak, less sizzle. Showed enough tantalizing stuff in the games he was healthy early in the year, but just has to do it at a more consistent level.
Terrence Shannon is a guy that you were high on. You had a first round grade on him in the 2021 draft class. Mm-hmm. I was a little bit lower. I don't love the offensive feel necessarily, but one of the best wing defenders in the 2021 draft class, and he will be one of the best wing defenders in the 2022 draft class.
I was surprised he went back to school. Everything I was kind of hearing that he had one foot out the door, has to assert himself. He can't be the guy that didn't start some games and close some games, and the shot needs to stay on that trajectory. He bumped it from 26% to 36%, has a pop off the floor. The numbers and the offense didn't always allow him to show those kind of self-creation skills, and he's the alpha now on a team at Texas Tech that doesn't have Mac McClung, and they have 7 transfers, so there's this offensive hole in the backcourt from the wing for him to be able to take over.
How do you think that Texas Tech team is going to look this year? Because I can't.
I'm fascinated. I overuse the word fascinating, but you have Sadar Calhoun from Florida State. He'll take some shots. I mean, you have Kevin O'Banner from Oral Roberts. You have Marco Santos Silva back. Yep. So for TJ, it's like I don't want him to be a point guard like he was for stretches in the NCAA tournament and not just go like semi-hero mode, not full hero mode all the time.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And like they also have Bryson Williams, who is going to try and take some shots. Right. And I liked Adonis Arms like quite a bit at Winthrop. Really interesting, like long prospect who's like 6'5", but you know, enormous. And there are some teams that the analytics model like actually kind of really likes him a little bit. And then you have TJ, who is a really valuable, like, defensive player right now. And I would bet you they sold him on being the guy coming back, right? So just a weird roster because, like, does Sadar Calhoun run the offense? Like, is that what we're going to do here?
I don't know. There are times in the tournament, and I went back and watched a game this week, and I watched a ton of games last year, but, like, TJ Shannon would take the ball and kind of, like, wave off everybody else. Like, no, I got it. Like, I'm point guard. I'm going to do this. I don't know how much Mark Adams is going to let that happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. We just don't know what Mark Adams' like philosophy is going to be either, like, as a head coach. So that part of it is interesting, too. Next up is a guy that I'm really high on, Hyunjin Lee out of Davidson, the only returning player in college basketball to average 10 points a game and shoot 50-40-90. Just a genuine elite shooter across the board. He's 6'7". He shoots off of movement. He shoots from NBA range, like, period, point blank, everything you're looking for as a shooter. I think he is the best shooter in the 2021 or 2022 NBA draft class.
Yeah, 50-44-90. He played on the South Korean national team, so I watched some of that stuff. He was a leader out there. He was a primary guard. They played fast. They moved the ball up the court. Then he'll make you pay with him trailing and waiting for kickouts, and a very good shooter, like you said. Fluid with the ball in the break, too, and seems to be playing with real confidence.
Yeah, definitely. The big key is defense. Just needs to prove he can defend at some level. From what I've been told, he's much stronger. Heading into this season, has gotten a lot more physical in his ability to just actually absorb contact, because at times he would kind of get blown through in a way that was a bit frustrating to see. And as a freshman, like, it was just hard for him. Like, he just didn't have the physicality. But I'm intrigued. I think that there's quite a bit here in terms of talent that he can bring. I would expect he'll be one of the best players in the A-10 this year.
Yeah, that league is consistently good as a alum of the Atlantic 10 Conference, and there are some high-level prospects there, or at least high-level guys that you do take a second look at, put it that way.
Okay, next up, we have got Tavion Kinsey at Marshall. Definitely a big numbers player. Like, for sure, he's a guy that averaged, if I remember correctly, I don't have the numbers up, but he was like right around 26-3 last year. 6'5", you know, very twitchy, athletic wing. Big thing, though, is like a lot of his stuff comes in transition, and I just wonder how that translates to the next level. But, you know, 53% from the field, 41 from three, and 82 from the line, according to my notes. So, needs to prove he can shoot from three consistently. Like, that's been the bugaboo throughout his career. Doesn't take a lot of them, doesn't look super confident taking them. But if he can prove he can shoot from three, there's a real shot that he's an NBA player.
Right. And I actually think he's a better passer and making reads than he's given credit for. The only other thing I'd add to you is I just want him to stop turning his back to pressure all the time. And that's a hold up. He had, I think it was top five in dunks last year in college basketball, and the transition stuff, the highlight reel is incredible, but just needs to make his mark more in the half court.
Yep, agree. Okay. Next for this is Alan Flanagan, who is going to miss the little early portion of the season here, as we spoke about on a previous podcast. He was really good for Auburn last year, averaged 14 points on 46 from the field, 34 from three, 77 from the line. Big physical, like 6'6", with what seemed to be pretty long arms, 220 pounds probably. Every reason to kind of believe that he looks like an NBA wing.
Right. It just size, strength at 6'6". His points jump from 3 points per game to 14 points per game from freshman and sophomore years. 34% from three. He's going to have to shoot it. There's still that expanded role with Sharif Cooper gone, JT Thor gone, even Justin Powell gone. The injury was a total bummer. I like him as a breakout candidate. I hope it doesn't take him too long to get his legs back on drum and play in the SEC.
Yep. Let's see. Oshai Agbaji, we kind of know what Oshai is at this point. He is a 6'5" guard at Kansas who has a frame, again, that looks very much like NBA players. He can knock down shots from distance. He hit 38% of 7 attempts per game last year. I think that there's just like glue missing from his game. Like, I think that the gears are turning every time I watch him play basketball. And he's a guy that looks like a great NBA prospect, where I've just never quite like come away thinking, oh no, he's it. Like, he's definitely an NBA player.
He was 6'5 and a half with shoes, with 6'10 wingspan, 4.5% body fat, big hands. So he passes the look test, passes the eye test. Very good defender. He can hit shots, just better when he limits his movements and isn't flying off of screens. Did average 14 points per game. You talk to some Kansas fans, and that like still mystifies them that he scored that many points per game. His three-point percentage has gone up each of his last 3 years. Just needs to have more of an in-between game, too. Similar to, like, that Ben Mathurin. Like, you have to do something beyond just threes or trying to dunk. And just not drift. Like, that's been another thing we don't try to. Just, you can't drift for long stretches.
Okay. Do we want to do Jordan Hall now or with the guards?
Yeah, it's interesting. I did all my notes for Jordan Hall, but he's probably more of a guard, or thinks he's a guard, so that might be one to table for next time.
Yeah, let's save him for next week. My king, Buddy Buckets, Buddy Boeheim over at Syracuse. What a strange year for Syracuse last year, because basically their season turned once they turned over their offense to the coach's kid.
Right.
I feel like typically that goes the other way. Like,
it can, yeah. I mean, Kadari Richmond did transfer, and I don't know necessarily because of it, but there were some defections that, hey, I guess it happens everywhere in college basketball. But he had that run for a couple weeks where the basket was just like him throwing a ball in the ocean. Like, he just couldn't miss.
Yeah, no, he averaged 22 points on 50% from the field, 46% from three, on 9 attempts from three per game, and 83% from the line over his final 12 games. So that's like a month and a half, the last month and a half he played last year. I'm assuming he's the preseason ACC player of the year. That's kind of my guess at this point. I mean, just an unreal shooter. That's what it comes down to. He is an incredible shooter who can generate three-point looks on his own. And I don't know if he can do anything else by NBA standards, but the shooting is real.
The shooting's really just sitting in that Syracuse zone. And scouts are always just a little leery, like, is Syracuse guy's his zone? Like, can he defend? Yeah, he could, but you just don't see as many reps. And I'm sure some Syracuse purists will say, like, we don't play nearly as much zone as we used to. It's like, yeah, but you still do for a lot of the game, so you can get away with sort of bad habits when you have so much length behind you and that second line of defense to clean up whatever your defensive inefficiencies or deficiencies may be.
So some other guys here: Josiah Jordan James, Justin Moore, Jared Roden at Seton Hall, Ron Harper Jr., I think we talked about Jalen Wilson last time a little bit. I mean, look, like, I have a bunch of names on my like super long list here of like 350 names, but
well, last year, didn't somebody stump you? Didn't you have somebody like not on your list who was drafted late? Can't remember who it was, but it was someone in the 50s.
Balsha got drafted. Balsha,
that's what it was. Yeah,
which was insane. Like, what in the world are we doing, Detroit? Like, it's bad because, like, I don't want to keep harping on it, but, like, good Lord.
But I'm going to harp. One name that I did want to bring up that I didn't say beforehand, and not trying to put you on the spot.
Ooh, here we go.
Marshawn Beauchamp?
Yeah, we should talk about Marshawn. That's a good point. Great year at the whatever, like, junior college played for. He was a top 50 prospect in the class of 2020. He was a guy that also, like, I've always kind of thought had a game that looked a little bit more like a pros game as opposed to a college game, just because he tends to be a player that, like, likes to go and try and score, like, on his own and not play a ton within like a team concept. Is that kind of the impression you got?
Yeah, you're doing a great job dancing around. He averaged 30 points per game and shot it every time he wanted to. But yes, totally. That was a great Rain Man rundown of Marshawn. 6'6", 7-foot wingspan, and his JUCO tape. So he was a top 50 guy coming out of high school. He opted to enroll in the Chameleon X training program for a year, then went to junior college, then was like dipping his toes a little bit, like, can I go to college at the high major level? And there's just some amateurism issues. So said, whatever, doing G League Ignite. His JUCO tape, he was bullying guys. I mean, he was so much better, clearly, than the competition that it's tough to gauge where he's at.
Just so much more physically gifted, particularly. Yeah.
And even if he wasn't, he was like burying his shoulder. It's not even like really his game, but he was just like punking guys.
Right. Yeah.
But he can come off screens, can create his own. Yeah. His handle's tight enough, can dribble both ways, post smaller players. His shot just kind of has like a little funky to it, a wide stance, a little slowish release. He did shoot 40%. He's a player with the G League Ignite that I see as having a chance to separate himself as sort of a little bit this forgotten guy as a player, as a prospect. And I sort of wrote him off when I didn't hear about him for a year. I'm like, oh, he went junior college, whatever. But reports have been that he's in really good shape and he looks great in workouts. So at least worth a mention here.
Yeah, and one other guy I want to mention is Justin Lewis at Marquette. He's more of like a forward than a wing, but I realize we didn't mention him last time. He didn't shoot well from three last year, but 6'7", has really long arms, moves really well away from the ball. I actually quite like him as a NBA prospect if he can knock down shots at some point.
Yeah, he had he definitely has moments as a freshman Marquette. He had like a game winner. I forget who they played. Don't have it on the top of my head. Don't kill me. But it was early in the year.
Yeah.
And then just had freshman stuff. Like he'd play 15 minutes one game, 10 the next. Doesn't really have the quickness. Sort of like one of these forward. I'd say he's more of a four. We probably just missed on him last week. Just figure it out guy.
Yeah.
Maybe that's also part of the reason why we don't know what to do with him, because he doesn't have a defined position. But there's people who have him kind of like their top 60 for sure for next year.
Yeah, definitely needs to shoot though. That's kind of what it comes down to. He was a terrible shooter last year, and if that doesn't change, it's going to be tough for him. Okay, that's everyone I've got. Is that everyone you've got?
Yeah, let me do the quick scan here to see if there's any major names. I think that, man, we whiffed on. We hammered the Pac-12. We'll talk Jordan next week. Yeah, because there's some, like, we separated out fours. So there's some like kind of like two threes that probably fit more in that like two category that we'll cover. We'll get to, not today's
podcast.
Yeah,
totally. Okay, let's do you want to do the many Saints of Newark thing?
Let's do it.
So overall, I think I'm glad that it exists. I think I'm glad that like I got to spend more time in the world.
Yes.
I don't think it was a particularly effective film, but I'm glad that like it exists and I got to see young Tony with like Michael Gandolfini, who I thought was pretty good, and the Dickie Moltisanti stuff was amazing. I didn't really like much else of it.
Okay, I'm in the same boat, I think, of you. The Sopranos for me was that might have been my first like appointment television TV show. This was like pre DVR, pre TiVo. That I remember, this was kind of like my first split screen experience. Of you had the Red Sox on one TV and Sunday Night HBO Sopranos on the other. Like you couldn't miss it. I couldn't miss it. So as much as I loved the show and I wanted to see more, with every prequel and remake, now after so many stinkers for other stuff, I'm like, just leave it alone. Like they don't remake Wedding Crashers. Just let it be. Like let those guys go live. So it was fun to go back into the world. But my friend Jeff made the point. It was sort of like the El Camino for Breaking Bad. Like you wanted like one more phase. So it was like a thing. It was definitely a movie. It was definitely a show. My hang up was I didn't think it was bad. Some people are crushing it. I didn't think it was bad.
No, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I couldn't get over like the Silvio and Polly Walnuts. And I understand you have to show who these characters are, but I thought some of it was like the mannerisms were so far over the top. It's like, dude, we get it. Like, you're Silvio. You don't have to do like the lead in, the head thing, like every single time, that it was just like beaten into you. It was hard for me to unsee that once I saw it the first time.
I honestly thought that the Silvio performance is one of the worst performances I've seen all year.
You're a movie guy. You can take those wild swings. I haven't earned that yet.
I have watched over, I think it's like, I counted earlier this week, I think I've watched over 110 2021 releases.
Jeez.
It's one of the worst performances I've seen this year. It is it was unconscionably bad, I thought.
Yeah, like,
it was distracting. I actually thought that Pauly was pretty good. Billy Magnuson, I thought that guy was good. The Silvio one was just like totally distracting. It totally removed you from the world of the film in a way that was just ridiculous, I thought.
I did. Tony's mom, I thought, was great. It set at least the stage for his issues as he got older. Just the story itself, and I just hadn't watched The Sopranos in a long time, but like there were some callbacks. I was like, oh yeah, that's that thing. But it just had been so long that I didn't brush up before I watched it. And the story, it was in that world, but it felt like it was like in a different planet, if that makes sense. Like, this stuff didn't really like coincide. Like, I understood what they were trying to do. And with David Chase, all the articles were like, he turned down scripts for 15 years. I didn't think this was the worst script, but I don't know if like this was the one. Like, I'm going to use my bullet on this.
So I thought the story was actually quite good. I understood why this was the story he wanted to tell. The problem was that I thought that there was enough plot for like a 7-episode miniseries.
Yes,
not
yes.
A movie. Like, to me, it's not an accident that all of the characters felt a bit underbaked, I thought, outside of Dickie, because you spend the most time with Dickie. Like, it's a lot of the movie is from his perspective. Like, most of it is from his perspective. And
did you care about Dickie's perspective? That was my other criticism. It's like, okay, cool, I don't really care about this character. I did in like the movie, but in like the Sopranos grand scheme of things, I want to know about like everything else.
Yeah, I think that the movie made me care, which is a credit to the movie.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, yep, I thought that it made me care about Dickie. I thought that Alessandro Nivola's performance made me care about Dickie. Like, I thought he was phenomenal in the movie.
Very good, yes.
But then you throw in all the other stuff, like the Leslie Odom Jr. stuff. I don't want to say it seemed tacked on. It just seemed like a bit underbaked, because, like, I don't know what his motivations were. Like, there's that little scene of him talking about how he wanted to go to the war with his partner, and I guess that that's like part of the motivation, but beyond just like power hungriness, like I didn't really get it. With like Corey Stoll, the movie relies a lot on what your preconceived notions of the characters are, as opposed to actually building character development. I thought, like, Corey Stoll, in like, spoiler alert now for sure, like, we've talked a lot about like things that happen in the movie, but like, we haven't like spoiled it, but like, now, you know, if you want to pause, like, please hit pause. If you don't want to know what happens. So, like, Corey Stoll with Junior, like, Junior plays, like, the critical role in the end of the movie.
Right.
Where he makes the call, essentially, to have Dickie killed because he laughs at him falling down, some steps. Mm-hmm. Right? And I don't think there's really any point in the movie where we get to know Junior beyond just knowing what our preconceived notions are. Like, we see the scene with his, I think, is it his wife? Like, I don't even remember Junior being married. Like, Junior had the girlfriend in Sopranos at one point, but I don't remember him being married. It could have just been, like, a woman that he was with that night. Like, he was laughing. He was mad that Dickie was laughing at him as he fell down the stairs. And I guess that, like, to me, that scene just totally relied upon our knowledge that Junior is petty, not like any sort of character development that the movie had done beforehand with Junior that makes me understand his perspective and how he became petty later in life. You know what I mean?
I do. And I didn't hate the journey we sort of went on together, but then it ends with a pinky swear. And I'm like, what? And then the original theme song hits. I'm like, all right, I'm good. Like, I'm ready for 6 more hours of TV. Let's do it. It's like, roll credits. You're gone forever. I'm like, wait, what? Like, we just kind of got here. I was starting to dig, like, the... You know they'd pepper in the Tony Soprano stuff about, oh, he's just really gifted. The test show, he's a leader. He just doesn't like school. And we're finally getting there with him. And then it ends. And you're probably never seeing anything again. Unless something else was written that they're adding to it. But it feels like that was a standalone.
So David Chase has signed a production deal with Warner Brothers. I think the Hollywood Reporter reported that, which makes me think that, like, we could see more of these movies at some point. I don't know. I think
the TV thing's probably gone, though, I would guess. And I'd prefer, like, what you're saying, to take your time, do 4 episodes. Doesn't have to be 6. Doesn't have to be 10, like some of these other series. I'd appreciate 4 if there was just more development. Now that I won't go full spoiler mode, and I guess, but one of the main characters isn't there, and you can kind of do more stuff with Janice and more stuff with Tony's mom and more stuff with Tony's dad. There's other kind of places I'd like to explore and dig deeper into, because there's so many questions, and just the real Sopranos finale, we don't really know what happened. I don't know if they'll ever get to there, but more breadcrumbs and more clues and just more Sopranos worlds would be good for everybody.
Well, and I think that, like, the reason that I would prefer TV from David Chase as opposed to movies is that, think back to The Sopranos, it's a lot more character-driven in terms of just, like, in terms of being languorous and being dwelling on certain things and extending out longer conversations. And it's a very, like, internal show in a lot of ways, whereas movies have to be a lot more plot driven because you only have between 90 minutes and 135 minutes, right, to tell your story. So I think that David Chase just generally excels more within a TV construct where he is able to spend that time kind of pulling out all of the character development, like, one strand at a time, if that makes sense.
He's a half-court offensive guy. He doesn't want to play. We don't want to play up-tempo. That movie was up-tempo. Shoot in the half court. It's where you play well. Run your cuts. Run your back cuts. It was still good. I don't want to completely crush it. My dad wasn't psyched. Yeah. I tell people, like, well, what was that thing? I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, it was a good, like, Friday night, like, kind of go back into that nostalgic place. And Sopranos did take time. I mean, there's episodes with Dr. Melfi or whatever, and almost half seasons. Like, where is this going? And then the payoff comes. Right. It's, wow, that was great. Like, I should have had more patience. It's almost like season 2 of The Wire. And then you step back and it's like, that was actually brilliant the way they framed it and did it. But if the Wire and Sopranos were a 2-hour movie, like, I don't think I would appreciate either series as much.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. Man, I miss going to the movies. That's my life right now. I miss going to the movies.
Yeah. Well, I hope one day you can watch the next 1,000 in theaters and not in your multiple screens you have going at the same time.
Yeah, I'm hoping that, like, I don't know when theaters reopen. I'm hoping that they reopen, like, end of October when the lockdown is supposed to end. I need to go to the movies, man. Like,
you need to get out of your house, because I could go to a movie theater here, but when I saw The Many Saints of Newark, where I was on HBO Max and streaming, I said, that is great. I'll be watching that from my couch.
Like, we've got No Time to Die coming. We've got that ridiculous looking Last Duel movie with your guys, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
Like, guys, yes.
We've got Eternals. Yeah, we've got Last Night in Soho. Like, we've got so many movies coming where I need to see them on a big screen. You know, I wanted to see The Night House on a big screen, but, you know, unfortunately, that was just not not something that was ever going to happen. So I need movie theaters back, Penny. That's where I'm at in my life.
Well, I'll that's my next wish for you. Next wishing while throwing a spare coin and say this one's for my friend Sam.
Save those wishes for the small child, for baby Penny, yeah. Please.
I wish he'd sleep past 5 a.m. That's the first wish. Then the next one's for you, buddy.
That one's for you. I don't think that's for you. This baby
is
me. Penny.
This one is Sam, yes.
Or toddler Penny, I guess it is now.
Big baby, Glenn Davis.
Penny, tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on in your life here.
We're close this season. I've made my schedule of games and try to be out a little bit more on the road, but for the time being I'm on Twitter, @Matt_Penny, trying not to react too much to preseason rankings and too much to NBA preseason games, but I'm just like everybody else. I'm gonna overreact.
Speaking of overreacting, there is one more thing we have to talk about.
Oh boy.
The Imani Bates stuff.
No, that's a full episode, but go ahead. What do you got?
Look, I don't want it to be a full episode. That's why we're doing it at the end here.
Okay.
Look, the measurements came out from Memphis's Pro Day, and I think people like melted down when they saw his wingspan at 6'7¼". That's just what his length has been. If you've been listening to this podcast for the last 18 months, 2 years, whatever, we've talked about this. Like, Penny and I have brought this up multiple times. Right. Yeah. I don't need to belabor it, I guess. He does not have long arms. That's why Matt and I have been a little bit more, I don't even want to say hesitant in turn, but like, we haven't anointed him.
Guarded.
Right? As like the next guy. Unequivocally the guy that's gonna like play in the NBA for years and be like a superstar player. Small hands as well, like that came out. I don't really care about the testing numbers, the vertical jump, vertical leap, or max vertical leap, three-quarter court sprint, all that stuff, because when players go through the pre-draft process, they get specific training for those measurements, right? Like, they train to max their vertical leap out. I can't imagine that Imani Bates is doing that right now. So when he goes to the NBA draft combine in 2 years, I would imagine his vertical leap ends up something in the range of like 35, 36 inches, and it's fine. You know, like, it's just like not worth melting down about. I don't think any of this is worth melting down about because it's stuff that we've known for a while. And I don't think it changes our evaluation of Imani Bates, I guess, is kind of where I'm at.
My moral meltdown was that he was 6'9", because I don't think he's 6'9". Maybe with shoes. I don't think it was noted on that roster there that was posted, that Jonathan Givony posted and was retweeted and quote tweeted and all that. The hand stuff, the athletic testing, I'm not totally blown away. It's just, you can't hide from the measuring stick and the stopwatch forever. Like, eventually you're going to get hard numbers, and that's what they are. It hurts his ceiling a little bit with his length, because I think comparatively speaking with other combine type results, it's just a little bit of a anomaly, I guess I'd say. I did take some pleasure in reading the internet prior to recording this, and there are some people saying he's a bust. There's some people saying Tom Brady didn't measure out well. There's some people referencing Kevin Durant. I said, well, Kevin Durant couldn't bench press 185 pounds. And his line was, we don't need to do weights. Give me a ball. I'll play anybody one-on-one right now and win. And he was right. But Kevin Durant's wingspan is 9 feet long. So it's just different, the comparisons people are making. I'm more so interested in 2 years, because he's not draft eligible. In 2 years, what does it look like? I talked to about 3 scouts that are there today, and they said he was good. He's got ways to go. He looks like he's a freshman. No one left there saying that's a top 5 pick. That's okay. Like, there also the Jalen Duren stuff. Some people say he looked amazing. Some people said he was fine. It's the first open practice for all these kids who've had funky schedules because of the pandemic. They're just playing with these guys together for, like, when did Amani Bates, like, commit? A few weeks ago? Like, he's been on campus for, like, a few weeks. It's an adjustment period for everybody. I'm a little worried. I'm a little hesitant. But it doesn't change overall because, like you said, I just have never been quite as high. He was a really highly rated player as a 14, 15-year-old. People catch up, which is natural. He can still really score the ball. He has really good self-creation. He can facilitate. But the NBA is big boy stuff, and we'll just kind of see how it plays and morphs itself here as the season starts in a few weeks, like actually starts with games.
Yep. No, nothing that we have seen, I guess nothing from today worries me more or less about Imani Bates, I think is the point. Like,
yep.
I think you and I have just kind of maybe been ahead of the ball game in terms of not questioning him, but just acknowledging the reality of some things. Maybe that's the way to put it, right?
We're pumping the brakes. We're not slamming. We just pumped them a little bit early.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Penny has said goodbye already. Now I'm going to say goodbye. This has been the Game 3 podcast. I'll be back Saturday morning with a podcast. I don't know what we'll talk about. Probably some new NBA news that has continued to break. Basically, like, we'll talk maybe about the weird salary cap machinations. We'll talk about some strange preseason stuff we've seen. I don't know. I'll talk about the NBA on the next podcast, though. But until next time, we will talk soon.